Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlohm. As a kid growing up mostly in Southern California, one of the places that captured my budding scientific curiosity and love of the sea was the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, which is part of the University of California, San Diego. Seeing its iconic pier jutting out into the Pacific at the lab's home in La Jolla always made me curious to find out what exactly goes on there. And in this program, a much older version of me gets to do just that. Later on in the show, we'll talk to Robert Monroe, who works for Scripps as a media contact. He's also the author of the book, Scripps Institution of Oceanography, published in 2021. We'll also visit with geophysics professor Jamin Greenbaum, who's done amazing work on the melting of Antarctic ice by warming ocean waters. But first, our guest is Sophia Merrifield. Sophia is a seagoing oceanographer at Scripps, and recently she received a Presidential Early Career Award for Scientists and Engineers from then-President Biden. Dr. Merrifield joins us now to talk about her career and what it's like to do science aboard the Scripps Institution's research vessels. Sophia Merrifield, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I'd like to know a little bit about your journey that brought you to Scripps. So tell us about how you first got interested in oceanography and where you went to school.
So I grew up in Hawaii. I'm very lucky to grow up in such a beautiful place and spent a lot of time at the beach as a kid. Wasn't a great surfer, but loved to boogie board. And then was fortunate to go to Yale University for undergraduate, my undergraduate education. And I started in physics, and I really enjoyed of the coursework. But as I went through the program, I was interested in something a little more applied. And so some of the options at Yale were in the geology and geophysics department. And I got to work with a physical oceanographer named Alexei Fedorov. And he was interested in ENSO, so El Nino Southern Oscillation. And I got to do a really interesting research project with him. In parallel, I did a degree in mechanical engineering. After my sophomore year, I really wanted to do something more applied and was able to pick up that major and worked with a wonderful professor named Nick Ouellette, who's now at Stanford, on an experimental turbulence apparatus. And I think between those two research opportunities, I was really interested in pursuing graduate school. And the feedback I got was, what would you rather do than study the ocean? And so I was fortunate to get into the joint program between MIT and Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and I studied physical oceanography there, and maybe the rest is history.
And now you're at Scripps Institution of Oceanography. Tell us just a little bit about that place and, you know, when you first got there and what it's like to work there, because it's such a special place. Just like Woods Hole on the East Coast, it's kind of the West Coast version, but it's just an amazing place for the study of the oceans and with such a deep history. What was it like for you the first time you stepped foot there and knew, like, this is where I'm going to be?
I think Scripps is absolutely amazing. I like to say that it's a little bit better than Woods Hole just because the weather's better and we can access deep water more easily.
San Diego's pretty nice.
San Diego is pretty nice. What I love about Scripps is just the rich history in ocean observing and really a commitment to going to sea and collecting observations, but also just the breadth of expertise. It's just really amazing to have colleagues that are doing, you know, incredible work in geophysics and biology and physics. It's really a wonderful and inspiring place to work.
And you are very interested in working with robotic vehicles, autonomous vehicles. You've got this wonderful engineering and physical oceanography background, and, you know, combining those two things, that's just such a perfect fit for you. Tell us about how that informs your approach to oceanography, the use of robotics.
Sure. I'm really fortunate to be at Scripps because there are such great facilities for going to sea and also just for testing things. We have a really wonderful research pier that I'm looking at out my window.
The famous pier. I can remember when I was a kid, and I grew up in Malibu, and when we would go to Southern California, I always, you know, that was, oh, there's the Scripps Pier. It was like, you know, so it was like the Kennedy Space Center to me, you know, for the ocean. So it really is an amazing pier.
It is an amazing pier. It has a slightly different connotation for me because I'm afraid of heights. So having to climb down the chain link ladder in your wetsuit to get on a small boat is actually something I dread.
Oh, that's funny. Well, you know, once you're at sea level, literally, then you're okay.
Yeah. But I think Scripps provides a really interesting place to do robotics research because we do have access to the ocean just right in our backyard. And so my group spends a lot of time putting a lot of different robotic systems off the pier and testing different behavioral algorithms. So we're interested in kind of mapping the seafloor or mapping the midwater column using these systems. And we think a lot about how to make real-time adaptive decisions and make the robots kind of more akin to self-driving cars. So the ability to kind of see a signal in real time and then adapt to that, make new measurements.
I also saw that you had the opportunity to be the chief scientist for, I think, a week or whatever it was, a period of time, aboard the research vessel Sally Ride. And Sally Ride was a personal hero to me, to many, many people. And some of my close friends were good friends of hers. She just was an amazing person. Tell us about what that was like to be, you know, what's it like to go out to sea on the Sally Ride?
So I actually got to be the chief scientist of one of the science verification cruises. So at the very beginning of Sally Ride's life, there are a number of cruises that are meant to kind of test the ship out for different applications. And so I had a pretty cool task. I was working with actually a small company that was developing kind of autonomous landing technology for small drones. And so we took the small boat off Sally Ride and we were launching and landing these drones from Sally Ride onto the small boat. And it was sort of a unique application of a research vessel, but it was really fun. And I go to sea a lot. I'm quite fortunate for that. And I think Sally Ride, especially being named after such an incredible woman, is just a great vessel. And it's been a joy to sail.
For people who are not familiar with the ship, can you just kind of tell us a little bit about her? Because it really is a special vessel.
Yeah, for sure. So the Sally Ride is the sister vessel to the Neil Armstrong, which is run out of Woods Hole. And it's a little bit smaller than a typical global class vessel, but it has almost all of the same capabilities. And so it's the type of research vessel that goes out to sea for long periods of time, so for weeks to months at a time. And it provides a lot of different observational capabilities built into the system, including kind of current mapping, seafloor mapping, meteorology, weather stations, flow-through systems, and also a CTD. So something that's kind of conventional in making observations of the water column. But it also has a lot of systems on the back deck that allow us to deploy robotic vehicles. And so what's really great is that every time you go to sea, you sort of lay out the back deck differently. You bring different containers on, and then you ask for different capabilities of the ship. So sometimes they have to put different cranes or winches on in order to help you get your science done. And so what's really great about Sally Ride is that that ship was really designed kind of for the future and forward thinking about autonomous systems and new technologies that are coming onto the market.
One of the things that struck me in doing research on that beautiful ship was how much it reminded me of Star Trek and the Enterprise, because the Sally Ride is, you know, literally a science vessel that goes out to explore, you know, these unknown places, going out into the ocean, going to do research. And it goes out for very long periods of time with its crew, you know, years at a time sometimes. And the science folks like yourself, the teams of scientists come on for periods of time and then go back. But that's just an amazing thing to think about. That vessel really does. It reminds me of, you know, the principles behind Star Trek and, you know, exploring the unknown and the 5-year, you know, mission. Well, it goes out there for literally, you know, sometimes a couple of years at a time.
Totally. And I think what's really, really exciting about it is that you take your team and you fly to some port internationally and you meet people for the first time, but then you're living with them. You're having every meal of the day with them. And you're dependent on them because you need them to help you do your science. And I think it's just a really fascinating aspect about seagoing oceanography. It's fun. It's great to hear people's stories. People on ships have just amazing stories of experiences they've had. And it's kind of always an adventure.
I saw that you played soccer at Yale, correct?
I did, yes.
And so I'm curious because I was reading a bit about you when you were in your role as chief scientist there. You have to take on the role as kind of the head coach of the, you know, the team when you're going out and, you know, to make sure that everything flows smoothly. And it's, you know, got to be a lot of work and responsibility. But you made a comment that I thought was wonderful that you kind of want to have everybody get set up with base hits. And then the, you know, the doubles, the triples, the home runs can follow. Can you explain what you meant by that?
Yeah. When we're doing these complex operations where we're in a big team and we have a lot of kind of high value technology that may or may not work once it goes into the ocean, we often think about trying to get base hits. So just trying to do the simple thing that will start the process of kind of the bigger operation. And it kind of helps to break things up and break up kind of more complex tasks into achievable goals. But I also, I think something about my personality is I really care deeply about teamwork, and inspiring kind of the best out of people includes giving them responsibility and trusting them and really feeling confident in their contribution. And that's just been something that's been so rewarding about being at sea and being the chief scientist is getting to allocate kind of tasks and responsibilities to graduate students and young engineers in kind of complex environments.
Okay, tell us a little bit about some of the things that you like to research, some of the physical oceanography aspects, because you're studying surface interactions between the ocean and the atmosphere. Tell us about some of your research interests.
Sure. So I just got back from two cruises in the Western Pacific. One was in Palau and one was at Saipan and Tinian. And those are islands that are just north of Guam, in case they're not familiar with them. But what we've been studying is really the interaction of large-scale currents in the Western Pacific with these small-scale islands that have really complicated bathymetry. So they have kind of really steep kind of bathymetric slopes and also reefs and complicated kind of nearshore topography. And we're interested in how those currents interact with the islands, what happens to the resulting current once it's interacted with the island. And that leads to the generation of things like internal waves and vortices, the dissipation of energy. So how energy is kind of dissipated locally by turbulence, and also how kind of energy radiates away in the form of internal waves. And we're also interested in the biological implications for these flow topography interactions. So how you can actually bring nutrient-rich water up to the surface in these kind of wake interactions, which leads to higher productivity. And so we've been using kind of a wide variety of ocean technology, so autonomous systems and also radar, kind of to try to understand these processes from the surface and subsurface, and to kind of make observations in a collaborative way. So let's imagine that you wanted to really make sure you were in the right place at the right time. And so you were using kind of a remote sensing map to locate a feature you're interested in. And then you were asking your robot to go there and make really high resolution sample or measurements in that feature. And so that's what and we've been focused on a lot as a group. And we've been applying those techniques to really interesting kind of flow fields in the Western Pacific.
And you also share something in common with my very good friend, Josh Willis, from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, and also went to Scripps Institution of Oceanography. You won a very prestigious award that he also won a few years back. His was from President Obama. Yours was from President Biden. It's the Presidential Early Career Award for Scientists and Engineers. And tell us about what it was like when you found out you won that.
Oh my gosh, I was on the research vessel Tommy Thompson in the Western Pacific. I was just off of Saipan, and I found out that I won the award, and I was just completely shocked, and I'm just so appreciative of the honor. And you know, I had a close colleague on board, and I talked to him about it, and I called my family, and you know, lunchtime came, and we were running operations on the ship, and I went to, actually it might have been dinner, but I went to eat in the galley, and then all of a sudden this cake came out.
Aww.
And so someone on the ship had baked me a cake and decorated it. It was just absolutely beautiful. And everybody sort of congratulated me. And it was just a wonderful experience to be at sea, being the chief scientist of a cruise and to receive the award and to have such a generous and wonderful gesture. So I was really appreciative for that.
Yeah, gosh, talk about a perfect moment. That just sounds wonderful. It just from reading about you and talking to you, it's definitely well-deserved. Congratulations for that.
Oh, thank you so much.
I also saw that you taught a course or teaching a course at UC San Diego, which of course Scripps is a part of, called Hacking the Oceans. And I'd like to know a little bit about the title of the course and what it means and what you teach.
Sure. So I taught this course twice. It was called Hacking for the Oceans. And I think I'm going to continue to teach something that will evolve a little bit. But the heart of the course is really about having students from different backgrounds. We have students in engineering and oceanography and data science that are interested in environmental problems and want to learn kind of about how we might tackle them with technology. And so in Hacking for the Ocean, the students were in teams of four. And in that team, they were given a choice of a societally relevant environmental problem like illegal fishing or oil spills. And they were asked to come up with a technical solution. So a way of tackling that problem with kind of available technologies or data science techniques. And then they go out and they interview different people in the community. And those could be in industry, in the government. They can interview lifeguards and really try to understand what the problem is. So I had one team that was interested in rip current detection from aerial drones, and they went out onto the beach and they asked lifeguards, you know, how they handled rip currents. And the idea of the course is really to kind of get the students interested and trained in the environmental problem, but also aware of how it impacts the community beyond just how we think about it in science. And then for them to be exposed to the technologies and data science techniques that are emerging in our field and learn how to apply them to solve a problem.
And tell us, what do you most enjoy about your work there at Scripps Institution of Oceanography? What do you really love about going there every day?
I really love the dynamic environment, that every day we're tackling something different as a group. But I think the most rewarding thing is getting to help people. Some of the work we do that we weren't necessarily funded to do or we didn't propose to do is the most rewarding. And that can be when things come up like an oil spill or a search and rescue operation. And we really mobilize to try to help. So in the case of an oil spill, just a quick story that happened off of Huntington Beach a few years ago, we had a robot that was operating offshore and we actually retasked it to go to the area of the oil spill because there were very few wind observations and the system we were running had a meteorological package. And so we were able in real time to pass wind information in the location of the spill to other scientists and government workers that were looking at the problem. And also for search and rescue operations, similarly, we're able to kind of rapidly provide trajectory analysis support because we run a system of high frequency radars, which measure surface currents hourly in real time. And that data, those data are publicly available, but we have kind of unique sets of code that allow us to kind of rapidly help support agencies in those operations. So I would say the most rewarding thing to me about the job is really getting to help people with science and getting to use new technology as it kind of evolves and develops to tackle some pretty critical environmental problems.
Yeah, sometimes people don't appreciate that, you know, all the research that scientists do, you know, have very practical applications like that at times, which are so valuable to society. So thanks for being involved in that. And thanks for being our guest. It was a joy to talk to you, Sophia. And good luck with your future career, because I see nothing but even better things on your horizon.
Thank you so much, Dave.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our look at the work being done at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, part of the University of California at San Diego. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot as we profile some of the scientists and the rich history of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at the University of California, San Diego. Our next guest is a geophysicist at Scripps. Jamin Greenbaum specializes in studying how melting ice in Antarctica shapes sea level rise on a warming planet. Jamin Greenbaum, welcome to Blue Dot.
Oh, thanks very much. I really appreciate the opportunity to be with you.
All right. Well, first of all, I'd like to know a bit about you. Tell us about your journey and how you got interested in oceanography and being a geophysicist, and then how you got to Scripps.
Well, I came into earth science through aerospace engineering. I was originally totally dedicated to interplanetary exploration. That was my like singular interest for years. And so I studied engineering. I had some engineering jobs. And when I was wrapping up a master's, a couple things were going on. One was some realizations about climate change. This is sort of in the mid-2000s. The famous hockey stick plot was in the news at the time, and I noticed that. And I started noticing stories about uncertainty and sea level rise. And in particular, this sort of issue that sea level right now is lower than it should be, which is kind of a weird thing to say. But this was this thing I learned, that in sort of the glacial cycles, we're in an interglacial now, and sea level is 20 to 30 feet lower than it was the last time the Earth was like it is today, which was about 125,000 years ago. And all of these things kind of coalesced, and I thought, wow, this is really interesting. And the uncertainty comes from the polar regions. So I just want to dive into that head first and, you know, use the engineering skills that I had learned to just work on climate change and sea level rise in particular. And that's where this big transition happened about.
Tell us about like the first time you got to Scripps, because we're trying to profile what a special place this is. Tell me what your first impressions were when you got there.
Well, I mean, this place is like Science Disneyland is sort of one of the first things I said after I got to campus and started walking around and seeing the labs and the cool instruments and you know, autonomous systems that are built and, you know, crewed systems that are built, you know, and it's on the ocean, right? Like we have a pier, you know, outside my office, you can see the ocean. I mean, it's, you couldn't get any closer. and to have all these labs right there is a really special thing. And, it's a really special place to work. The job can be really stressful. And I think a lot, I've thought many times that just being able to come here and interact with the folks around here working on these amazing projects and just feel the inspiration and the history here just really, you know, gives me a lot of motivation. And it's and also a lot of sort of creativity. You know, I've been here since 2020, and I think it's been the most creative time of my career. I've cranked out, you know, a ton of proposals, done a lot of field work. We've built a lot of new things. And I really credit just being here to having that inspiration and creativity. The community around is, you know, it has folks that have worked on, you know, just the coolest oceanography projects that I know of, at least. And, you know, they're just around. And so you can chat with them and brainstorm and stuff. It's great. It's a really, really, really special place.
Well, tell us a bit about some of your research interests. You said some things you're very proud of. What are some of the things you are most proud of? Tell us about them.
Well, you know, like I said at the beginning, my interest is in understanding the processes that are driving sea level rise today and that will drive sea level rise into the future. And so, you know, I spent many years collecting data over the Antarctic continent because there were just these enormous gaps, like Texas-sized areas, you can imagine that, where there was no information about the bottom of the ice. And so that was kind of the first problem, is just what is the sea level potential in Antarctica? And that's what we worked on finishing. So around 2016, 2017, we finally finished the last big gap in the last Texas-sized chunk we surveyed. And that's great. You know, we have that map now. The problem is sea level rise from Antarctica is accelerating. And the reason is the ocean is melting the ice. But to get to the ice, the ocean has to traverse the continental shelf around Antarctica, which is basically unsurveyed and definitely unmonitored. So the one place that's the most important for understanding contemporary change in Antarctica is the least observed and the least monitored. That's the problem. That is why our sea level predictions are not accurate, because you can't forecast a system that you haven't observed, right? So that was the sort of light bulb moment in 2019 for me when I applied to work here, because the problem is in the ocean. And so I need to be at an oceanographic institution. And so being here, you know, the thing that made sense to come here on the science side was that. On the operational side is that, you know, I have, coming here, I had, you know, a decade and a half of experience using airborne platforms in polar regions. And so the vision for coming here is, okay, let's use airborne platforms at an oceanographic institution to get the data that we need to understand the processes driving sea level rise. And so that is where like my background and this institution coming together makes sense. And so that's been my focus, is doing oceanography with airborne platforms, which I believe have been underutilized historically for this problem, which makes sense, obviously, right? If it's an ocean problem, you would normally use ocean platforms. But the problem is, it's like you can't get those platforms safely to the places where you need the data because there's ice in the way, very thick ice. You know, it could be, you know, 1,000 feet or more of ice thickness floating in the way of a ship getting to where you need to go. But an airborne platform, a helicopter, a fixed wing aircraft, a drone can fly to some of these areas. And that's the work that I've been doing.
This reminds me very much of the work that my good friend Josh Willis has been doing for the past few years out of NASA JPL. He's an oceanographer from Scripps too, studying Greenland, called OMG, Oceans Melting Greenland. This sounds very similar. Tell us about some of the technology used to, you know, deploy instrumentation from aircraft to study the melting of these ices.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Josh Willis, because the work that they've been doing at JPL is awesome. And I've followed the Oceans Melting Greenland project closely, and he's helped me out, actually. I've reached out to him and he's given me some advice for some of the work that we've done here. Because at the beginning of my time here, we were deploying similar instruments, basically expendable sensors that you can deploy from fixed wing aircraft, a lot like the same instruments that they were deploying in Greenland. They're called airborne expendable conductivity temperature depth sensors. So we deployed those same instruments from aircraft in a few different places in Antarctica, from incidentally the same type of aircraft that the Oceans Melting Greenland project was using in the Arctic. So yeah, there's a lot of overlap in approach there. The last few years, our work at Thwaites has forced us to innovate because of the opportunity there to collect data in these really gnarly places where the ice shelf, the part of the floating extension of Thwaites Glacier, has collapsed into this enormous field of icebergs and sea ice and melange between the two. That's really amazing to comprehend when you're there, because it just looks like this wasteland of ice. It's really alarming to see, actually. But what we found in these rifts, which can be between, you know, which are between ice that can be, you know, 1,000-2,000 feet thick, if you can visualize that, we found these little places where you can get to the ocean if you just can break, you know, a centimeter or so of ice, which is not that bad. So what we started doing in the last couple of years is making these objects that we throw out of helicopters to break the ice, so that we can then carefully lower expendable sensors into the broken up ice and collect ocean profiles and seafloor depth in these really valuable locations. And that's been pretty good. And we've seen some really interesting data. There's this amplification of heat in the upper layers of the ocean, right where the ice is located, that we're observing, which correlates with the higher melt rates, right? So we think we're sort of seeing the smoking gun, so to speak, of what's driving these high melt rates. But what's frustrating is that you really want more variables than temperature and salinity alone to understand the processes that are active in that environment, right? There's other things like oxygen, for example, that you want. You want water velocity. You'd love to get biogeochemical variables too, to see what the impact is on, you know, phytoplankton communities, for example, in these high melt zones. So what you want to do is get the capability of an icebreaker into these enormous rifts. Like, that is the goal. And so that's what we've been working on really hard for the last couple of years, is to build a system that a helicopter can just drop off, that can break the ice, and then we can control it from anywhere in the world using Starlink. It has solar panels and batteries. And the idea is to be able to lower a science package into the ocean in these rifts to collect those additional variables and also capture water samples, which we then take back to the ship, because the helicopter can then pick the system up again when it's finished its profile. And then the helicopter can carry it back to the ship and we can process water samples. So it's like getting the capabilities of the ship, no compromises on data quality or data type. And we can get that into the workflow to really try to dial down the processes that are enhancing the melt in these places.
Yeah, wow, that's very interesting to think about how, you know, that more holistic look gives you a much better picture of what's actually going on, how the oceans are interacting with this ice. When you're using fixed wing aircraft, where are you flying out of?
Well, most of our fixed wing work occurs in East Antarctica. Mm-hmm. And we've worked from basically along the entire Indo-Pacific margin. So if you're looking at a map and going down to Antarctica from India, that would be the sort of westernmost side of where we've been working. And then if you go east all the way around to where New Zealand would connect, if you were to draw a line of longitude down from New Zealand, it's that whole sector basically from India past Australia over to New Zealand. That, if you were to draw a big pie slice to the South Pole, it's that sector we've been working. And so those, that's been in collaboration with almost a dozen other nations to do that work, because you can't go to different parts of Antarctica without traveling quite a ways. And so you work with the nation that runs the research base. So a lot of that work has been done with the Australian Antarctic Division, for example, because they have logistics and scientific interest in those areas. And so so we have a very close collaboration with them and many other programs too.
And before we let you go, tell me what do you find most rewarding about your work on Antarctica and, you know, the look at sea level rise and sea levels around the world? What do you find most rewarding about your work, and what do you enjoy most about being there at Scripps?
You know, I'm very lucky. I really enjoy this job a lot. And so it's a hard question to answer, but I think the first thing that pops into my head when you ask that is really the international collaborative nature of what we do. That, I think, is the most rewarding part for a variety of reasons, but I would say mainly it's that, you know, it's this idea that in order to tackle these big problems, like in this case, it's map Antarctica, find the processes driving melt so we can predict sea level rise, right? That's our challenge. That is not possible to do from a single nation because of just the spatial scales that we're talking about, right? Antarctica is enormous. And so you need to collaborate to study the whole thing. And so it's just not possible without working internationally. And to be able to do that, you know, to accomplish this, you know, large goal, for example, of finishing the map of Antarctica, knowing that you did that with a multinational team, and, you know, making an example for how we can tackle climate change, right? How are we going to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, right? That's going to be a international collaborative problem. And so I'd say that is the most rewarding thing, is it feels like we're making a statement for how to work together to solve a giant problem. And that's, I think, been the most rewarding part of the job.
And as briefly as you can, are you hopeful that we'll be able to, you know, collaborate and solve this global problem?
I am. Yeah, I think, you know, we have to be optimistic. We have to be optimistic and creative and collaborative. If we can be optimistic, creative, and collaborative, we can solve this problem. And we've done it before, and we have the technology. I think we have the will. We just have to do it now. And so, yes, I am optimistic.
Well, Jamin Greenbaum, Assistant Research Geophysicist for Scripps Institution of Oceanography at the University of California, San Diego, thanks for sharing your passion and your expertise on this really vital and important part of the ocean interactions with the rest of our planet.
Oh, thanks very much for having me. It was great to meet you.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our look at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego by examining its rich history. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. We're now joined by Robert Monroe. Robert works at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography as a media contact person and writer. He's also the author of the book, Scripps Institution of Oceanography, which is part of the Images of America series published by Arcadia in 2021. Robert Monroe, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Well, a lot of our listeners and people I know are not familiar with the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. Tell us a bit about the origins of Scripps and William Ritter. Tell us how it all began.
Yeah, well, actually, the story of Scripps began at Cal Berkeley right at the turn of the century. William Ritter was a biologist at Cal who was very interested in doing marine biology studies somewhere on the coast of California. And to do that, he needed to find a place where he could easily get small boats out into the ocean quick, which pretty much right away excluded San Francisco Bay. And then he went down the coast to Los Angeles. And in fact, in 1902, he had a little lab in San Pedro. But even by 1902, it was already starting to become a huge commercial port. So he didn't think that was going to work out very well. And then he kept on going down the coast until he found San Diego. In 1903, he got to know some of the city fathers of San Diego at the time, members of the city government who were very excited about the idea of having something prestigious in town, because San Diego was still a bit of a backwater then. So they set him up at the Hotel Del Coronado in its boathouse. And that's where what was then called the Marine Biological Association of San Diego was formed. And for 2 years, that is where it did all its work. However, the boathouse was really not very good for being a lab. It was just clunky and messy and so forth, and just did not suit itself to lab needs. So in 1905, Dr. Ritter decided to move the show up to La Jolla, California, which is about like 15 miles north of where Hotel Del is. And then in 1905, Ritter started a new lab. It was first known as the Little Green Lab because it was actually a little green building, not very big. But by order of the charter of the Marine Biological Association, it did have a little aquarium that was open to the public. And the small number of researchers who worked there always gave public lectures, and that's attracted a lot of people around La Jolla, including Ellen Browning Scripps. Ellen Browning Scripps was the half-sister of E.W. Scripps, who was a huge newspaper magnate, sort of a William Randolph Hearst before William Randolph Hearst was around. And she got very excited about Scripps, or well, about the Marine Biological Association, and was the first real big benefactor of the institution. And she brought her brother into it more and more. And they were the ones who founded the first building on what is now the present day Scripps Oceanography Campus in La Jolla.
And how did the affiliation get started with the actual University of California? Because it's part of UC San Diego.
Well, it is now, but at the time, it was a very far-flung outpost of Cal Berkeley still. Well, Ritter still was a member of the faculty of Cal Berkeley. And so in those very first years, if someone got a PhD from Scripps in oceanography, it actually read UC Berkeley on the diploma. And so the relationship developed, and I think in large part because Ellen Browning Scripps was backing up the institution financially, the University of California was willing to let it continue to grow as a station, remote from other things, but still very fully functioning. And then in 1912, the institution really solidified its connection with the University of California and became a formal part of it as its own standalone institution.
And of course, when I think of Scripps as a Southern California kid, the famous pier always comes to mind, visualizing, you know, driving along the coast highway there and seeing the pier. And I was, oh, yeah, there's Scripps. Tell us about that pier, because it really is iconic.
Yeah, it is kind of like our Eiffel Tower, or the, you know, the landmark that kind of identifies us. It was built in 1916, again, thanks to Ellen Browning Scripps. And the first iteration of it was made entirely out of wood. People were able to go fishing off of it for 25 cents a day in the first few years. But almost immediately, the pier was put to work. Even today, there are numerous scientific instruments on the edge of the pier measuring surface currents and amounts of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and met stations and so forth. And one fun thing that happens on the pier every single day since 1916 is that a person walks out to the end of it and takes a measurement of seawater at the surface and at the seafloor right below, and takes the temperature and measures the salinity. And this has been done by hand now for whatever that is, 109 years, and that makes it the oldest record of temperature, at least in the Pacific Ocean, and certainly one of the top ones in the world.
Yeah, that's amazing. And to think that it's, you know, that it's done every day by hand and has been for so many years, it's just, that's astonishing. Okay, tell us a bit about the role of Scripps in wartime, because you also have a very close relationship with the U.S. Navy. You know, they actually are the ones that have the vessels, the research vessels you use. They're chartered to you or whatever. But tell us about the role of Scripps in wartime, because it really did have some amazing contributions, especially during World War II, to the study of tides in the ocean and, you know, for all of those landing operations, both in the Pacific and in the Atlantic.
Yeah, well, Scripps's association with the military really goes back to right after World War I, and submarine warfare is starting to become a thing. And so the U.S. government decided to start investing heavily in Scripps. Scripps was the only place that was conferring oceanographic degrees at that time. And so then we get to World War II, and the government again invests heavily in Scripps. The University of California creates what is called the Department of War Research and situated it in Point Loma, California, which is now at a place that belongs to Scripps and is where our ships are all docked. But from this place, all sorts of crazy important breakthroughs took place. At the beginning, this lab in Point Loma was filled with physicists and a bunch of oceanographers, and the physicists really looked down on the oceanographers. And they sort of were in their little tribes trying to figure out basic ocean problems, like how can you see a submarine underwater when it's so dark? And the physicists had the idea of, well, let's make a really big flashlight and we'll just like beam it at things. So they built like a really big flashlight, and they tried pointing it underwater, and it went about 100 feet, the beam, and then it just dissolved into what we now call backscatter, which is just the stuff that's always floating in the ocean. not very successful.
You would think physicists would be able to figure that out ahead of time, that that's not really the way to go.
Yeah. Well, there's a funny ending to that story. But anyways, the oceanographers did come up with the beginnings of sonar research and figuring out that you can detect things using sound much better than visually in the ocean. And that led to all sorts of breakthroughs. There was one funny story about how one of our marine biologists, when listening to things happening in the ocean, heard like this really clickety clackety clickety on the seafloor. They couldn't figure out what it was until they looked, and it was gigantic schools of snapping shrimp. And the Navy learned that they could hide submarines in these big schools right next to them, and no one could hear the submarines because all they could hear the clacking of these snapping shrimp.
Wow.
So as the war progressed, more and more sophisticated research was being done. By the way, those physicists who bombed out at Point Loma went on to another project called the Manhattan Project and built an atomic bomb. So they were not entirely useless, I guess.
Well, they bombed out there and bombed in somewhere else.
That's right. Yeah, that's the way to put it. Some of the more lasting things that came out of our World War II research were forecasts of waves, wave periods, and ocean swells. And that became absolutely crucial for things like beach landings. We had two major people at Scripps who were leading that. One was a student named Walter Monk, who went on to become pretty much our most famous alum, and Scripps' director at the time, a guy named Harold Sverdrup. And so they, starting in like 1941, 1942, would sit and figure out mathematical formulas to figure out how to predict what wave activity would be on any given day. And so this is a brand new technology. But the Allies put it to work almost immediately. By this time, Scripps Oceanography was affiliated with UCLA. So Sverdrup and sometimes Walter Monk would drive up to UCLA and teach members of the new Army Air Corps Meteorology Division to, you know, learn this forecasting technique. And those guys were the ones who drew up plans for many of the major invasions in Europe and Japan, including D-Day. And I know there's one story that Dwight Eisenhower, before the D-Day invasion, wrote up a resignation letter just in anticipation, like if it didn't go right, he was worried that the forecast would be wrong, that the soldiers disembarking, trying to land on the beach, would be overcome by waves in addition to everything else they had going on, and that would be a failure. Luckily, he was able to keep that resignation letter in his desk, not having needed it, because the predictions made by the people that were trained by Monk and Sverdrup worked. And to this day, every time you hear a surf forecast in the morning, it is using that same science to inform how big your waves are going to be on your local beach.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't they write one of the very first real oceanography texts?
Yeah, they did. And in fact, I think almost more than anything, this is what defined Scripps as like the place of oceanography. The term oceanography barely even existed when Scripps started. I think the word was first used in maybe the 1880s or so. So the brand new concepts. But what Scripps did in the 1940s was to create the first really comprehensive textbook of oceanography. And in a sense, that defined forevermore what oceanography was. If it's in that book, it's oceanography, you know. And in fact, a funny thing about that book is it was considered such a wartime asset that its distribution was restricted. You could not get it outside the United States because it was considered not quite top secret material, but
valuable.
Yes, valuable.
And before we let you go, like, do you have a favorite place on the Scripps campus that is like, this is just the coolest place?
Well, there's a few. I mean, besides our pier, there is a little party shack. My boss is going to kill me, but there's a little party shack that has existed since the 1950s. It's called Surfside, and it has had a party there every Friday night since the 1950s, and that's where everybody from Scripps comes and just hangs out and relaxes. And for me, it's the greatest place in the world to find out what's really going on. We all watch the sunset and drink our beers and eat our hors d'oeuvres. And it's just, I mean, it sort of encapsulates the kind of communal feel that there is here.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Well, Robert Monroe, Associate Director of Communications for the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, thanks for sharing, you know, a little bit of the history of this very special place and putting it into perspective for us.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to our guests from the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at the University of California, San Diego, oceanographer Sophia Merrifield, geophysicist Jamin Greenbaum, and writer media contact person Robert Monroe. You can learn more about their work at scripps.ucsd.edu. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode. On our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.